Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada, Prabhupada Ki. Srila Raghunath Das Goswami intended to go to Vrindavan to see the lotus feet of Rupa and Sanatan and then give up his life by jumping from Govardhan Hill. Purport. Jumping from the top of Govardhan Hill is a system of suicide especially performed by saintly persons. After the disappearance of Lord Chaitanya and Swarup Damodar, Raghunath Das Goswami keenly felt the separation of these two exalted personalities and therefore decided to give up his life by jumping from Govardhan Hill in Vrindavan. Before doing so, however, he wanted to see the lotus feet of Srila Rupa Goswami and Sanatan Goswami. Om Agyanasi Mirandasya Janandana Shalagaya Chakshurun Milisam Yena Chasmai Shri Kuravi Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stavitam Yena Bhusale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Svaparantikam Vancha Kalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyay Pacha Pati Tanam Pavani Pyu Vaishnavi Pyu Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadar Shri Vasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Okay, well, that's a nice light topic for a Saturday morning, suicide. Of course, a personality like Srila Raghunath Das Goswami is, you could easily say, on a different level than any of us here. So we should be very careful about following in the footsteps when he's performing pastimes like this. This is, of course, not recommended. Prabhupada says it many places that actually suicide is a sin. It's a sin. So it's not really recommended. However, for someone on the very exalted platform of Shuddha Sattva, like pure unalloyed devotion. We're dealing here with someone who gave up everything, comes from extremely wealthy background, and gives that up without, you know, not really a big deal. And his family members try to incarcerate him. He's not really affected by that so much. And in the process of his life, he actually gives up more or less sleeping and eating also. So this is some serious devotion we're dealing with here. So for him, rules and regulations, they don't work in the same way, right? We are sadhakas. We're trying to become devotees. That's why we are devotees, because of our intent on becoming devotees. That's our qualification. But it also means that we're not really sure how to be devotees because we have a material mind with a lot of material attachments, and that clouds our judgment, so to speak. So Srila Raghunath Das Goswami, it's not like that in the same way. His mind is attached to Krishna. Our mind is attached to all sorts of other different things. We know them as upadis, our false identities or false, you know, ideas of what will make me happy, right? Ultimately, coming from this idea that I am the center of attention and everything revolves around me, right? Doesn't matter which way I look, there's the world, that must mean I'm in the middle of it, right? So for us, there are rules, because we're in illusion. Everybody's an illusion, right? The question is, what type of illusion? So we have two types of maya, Mahamaya and Yoga Maya, right? There's no question of not being an illusion, because that's the quality of the jiva, is that it's very small. So how can something very small comprehend everything? Illusion. There is a limited knowledge available to us simply because of who we are. So if we are in Mahamaya, that means that we are in illusion about us being in control, right? So in Yoga Maya, that is not the illusion anymore. Then the illusion becomes how my relationship to God works, right? So Mother Yashoda, she just sees a little boy, right? Or Radharani sees a lover, or they don't really think so much about him being God, but he's just a really cool person. And then you have, like, in the Vaikuntha planets, they have more of this understanding that Krishna is God, but that then limits the relationship, because the whole awe and reverence is kind of in between. You know, like when you're seeing some very, like, high court judge or something, there's a limit to how much you can express what you think or feel. There's a lot of etiquette. It becomes prominent, right? So that actually inhibits the relationship. And then we have all sorts of other variations of how to connect with Krishna. We're kind of, you know, in between. Sometimes we're connecting with Krishna. Sometimes we may even understand we're connecting with Krishna. But sometimes we're actually connecting with ourselves and our false identities. So that's the problem, and that's why we are under rules and regulations. And that's why something like, I mean, ultimate, the suicide is quite a heavy one, right? It's something that is very strongly discouraged, right? Because it doesn't actually fix anything, you know, because this is a place of reformation. We're here to learn about our illusion so we can disentangle ourselves from it. So the idea of suicide doesn't really work, because it just means you didn't fix the problem. So the problem will continue after. So it doesn't really practically work anyway, right? And also, so why is it sinful? Well, it's sinful because in our position, in our state, it comes from an excessive frustration that I'm not getting things the way I want them, right? We have an idea inside our mind about what will make me happy. That idea is false when you're in Maya, when you're in the material world or dealing with the external energy. That idea is false. So if you get so frustrated that it's not working out, that you actually kill yourself, that means you haven't understood what the real problem is. The problem is not the world being not nice. The problem is that you're attached to the not nice world. Does that make sense? So I was just, you know, when people, they experience, we all experience problems in our life. And then sometimes what you do when you have a problem is you call the monk or write the monk. So just recently, two people contacted me who were both married, and they both had the same problem that they had everything, you know, job, nice job, children, house, everything was pretty nice. And their wife wants a divorce because she's bored. You know, she's not fulfilled. So they're contacting me. They're very, very frustrated because they've tried to create a nice environment. Everything's working out. Everything that we kind of say, okay, this is how family life plays out. And now the wife wants to leave them. So the idea that this is going to make me happy didn't really work out, right? Now, these two men are very frustrated because, I mean, over the course of like 15 years, you spend a lot of energy and time trying to make this a nice situation. And it is a nice situation, but it's not, because she's just not satisfied still, right? So the idea, I'm supposing they were in love, you know, love, when they first met their wife, and they had all these ideas and plans about, oh, this is going to be like this, and then two children, and we're going to have a nice car and everything, and this will make me happy. And now they have all these external things, and they're not happy. So that is frustrating, right? That's the problem. That's our illusion. We have an idea that the externals are what will generate my happiness, the external energy, nice car, nice job, beautiful wife, well-behaved children, whatever it is, that these externals are going to generate happiness. It's not. It's how we deal with those externals. The externals are just tools. We can use them for anything we want. You know, you can use a power drill to drill some holes, or you can use them to clean your ears. And one of them is going to work significantly better than the other. But if we think that it has anything really to do with the power drill, then we've missed the point. That's the illusion that, oh, the power drill is nice because I can do... It's only nice in a certain connection, if you connect it properly, right? So regardless of how you set yourself up in your life, if you're not ultimately connecting it back to Krishna, it's going to be a problem. It's just a matter of time when it's going to be a problem. Let's say the two guys from before, let's say the wives are happy. Let's say they're happy. It's still going to end at some point. And if we think this is going to be generating my happiness, it's going to stop. And then the happiness is gone. It's over. Right? So that's why we have to follow the rules. Because we're not dealing with the universe as if it is actually Krishna. Right? We're dealing with it as a place with some different facilities. Some are at my disposal, some are not at my disposal, and whatever I can do with that, that will make me either happy or not so happy. So, for someone like Srila Raghunath Das Goswami, it's different because he's having, you know, direct association of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You're doing pretty good, you could say. So that's different. Now, he's still limited. He's still a minute spirit soul. You know, he's not like... He's a devotee. So that means he's still an illusion. So when Mahaprabhu leaves, he doesn't... You know, I mean, intellectually, he would know that the whole universe is a manifestation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It doesn't really matter if I'm here or there, heaven or hell. That's the quality of the pure devotee. He doesn't really care where he is as long as there's some devotion going on, right? But that's not the prominent thing. Intellectual capacity is not prominent in the devotee because he's, I mean, at least on this level, he's so attached to Krishna that it becomes a very secondary thing. For us, it becomes primary because we're trying to figure out, what am I doing wrong here? How do I get out of this illusion? Because as long as I'm attached to the material, I can't be attached to Krishna. You have to let go of one, you know, like these trapeze artists. You have to let go of one before you can grab onto the other. So that's why intellectual capacity has a prominence in philosophy. We're discussing philosophy now, and what's the tattva, you know, tattva. It's because we are in this illusion that our mind is actually attached to the wrong side of our world, to the material side, right? So as we progress and purify ourselves, we will more and more find that we become attached to Krishna. And then the intellectual facet of devotional service takes a secondary role. We see that the gopis and Krishna, they sometimes discuss philosophy, but it's only to tease each other. It's actually switched around. They actually go against the philosophy. It's just to play around. They're not really agreeing on, you know, oh, that's some good tattva and the five layers of consciousness and covering. That they don't care about that. They care about, Krishna cares about the gopis, gopis care about Krishna. And everything else is just secondary to that. For us, it becomes primary because we're facing upside down, you could say, right? We have in Bhagavad Gita this idea of the banyan tree, that where the roots are upside down, and it's a whole confusing setup where it's difficult to figure out what's the right way, you know. So that's our situation. That's why the tattva is important, and also the rules and regulations, because they kind of keep us somewhat in line, at least. So that is why culture is so important, right? That the philosophy is the understanding of our identity, and then the culture is the expression of that identity. Now, everything goes from subtle to gross, right? That you have an idea and then you carry it out. So, where am I going with this? So the culture, yes. The culture is important because it keeps us in line, but it also does something else that's really kind of wonderful, is that it actually helps us awaken our dormant love of Krishna. Why? Because the culture is just a different aspect of the philosophy. It's just the gross aspect of the philosophy when it's put into practice. So it means that just like the holy name is not an artificial imposition on our mind, in the same way, the Vedic culture is also not actually artificially imposed on us. We think it is because we're in illusion. We've been, you know, conditioned in our life by something else. Some, you know, I'm from Scandinavia. I just came from a tour of Scandinavia. It looks kind of funny when I walk around like this. You know, I don't blend in, that's for sure. So then it would seem like, oh, this is weird, this is uncomfortable, but actually it's not. Now, materially, that's the case, that you don't, something gross doesn't generate something subtle. So what I mean is that if you have someone who is, maybe he has a gambling problem, and he walks around here in Britain, you have these gambling kind of shops or companies, where you can just walk in and gamble, right? And so if he walks through or past one of these, he has to be very self-controlled because he has this problem. Now, if I walk past that place, nothing happens, right? It doesn't mean anything. I look at it and it's like, okay, whatever. So the shop itself doesn't generate anything. It's only if I already have the samskara, if I already have this tendency or this illusion that this is going to make me happy, then it will spawn something. But it's already there. Does that make sense? So if you impose a materialistic culture on someone, it's not going to be comfortable for them. If I was to go to Africa and live with a tribe, it would be very strange for me, unless I had some kind of specific reason to do so. So, but the Vedic culture is not like that. It's actually inherently natural for us to follow the Vedic culture. Why? Because the Vedic culture is just an expression of what Krishna likes and doesn't like. Like cleanliness. He likes cleanliness. So if we read of Hari Bhakti Vilas, it'll explain a lot about how we keep ourselves clean. So cleanliness works whether you are a devotee or a materialist. You know, most, at least successful materialists, they take a bath in the morning. So it's not that we're not sectarian about this pushing Vedic culture. It's just knowledge about what works and what doesn't work so well, right? So this is the whole thing for us before we get to this level of Srila Raghunath Das Goswami, because he's on the level where everything is just lila. It's just interaction with the Lord and the whole, I'm going to kill myself. Spoiler alert, by the way, he doesn't do that. You know, Rupa and Sanatan say, look, chill out. It's okay, just hang out with us for a while and we'll do great things. So it all works out. But for us, if we have this idea, or you know, that no, I'm going to kill myself, then it comes from a different mindset. So for us to avoid situations like that, philosophy is important, but also the culture is important, that we follow the culture, because it works from both sides, then, both from the subtle, from the understanding, but also from the gross. So we're kind of safe in that. Does that make sense? That it's support. because we're whimsical now. That's the problem with our illusion, is that we're whimsical. We have these temporary ideas about what's going to make me successful. And they're all completely arbitrary. You know, they're just based on what has happened. That's like, and even you could go even further and say the whole materialistic culture is arbitrary. Now, why is it that we, Thanksgiving, right? What is that? It's just a bunch of people get together, they eat and drink until they pass out, and then they go for this Black Friday, the day after, I think, is the day after Thanksgiving, and go crazy in shopping, right? Why is that? Why is that? The reason is that Henry VIII, you know, he was an interesting character. He was breaking free from the Catholic Church because he didn't like the Pope. Now, he had a problem because the Catholics had all the cool parties. You know, they had all these festivals and stuff. Nothing close to what we have, but by comparison. Jai Shishi Radha Gokula Nanda Ki Shishi Shita Ram Laksman Hanumana Ki Goranitai Ki. So he was complaining because they had all these cool festivals, and he decided, no, this harvest festival, we're going to make that a big thing, you know. So it's just a matter of power. It's just, you know, this idea that I want to be in the control of things, and that was Henry VIII's position, just like it's our position, and then that becomes a big thing. And now it's just, you know, if you go to America, you just, anything, if you can make money off it, it's great. So now it's just become this great consumer party, right? So in Grenada, Thanksgiving is something different. Thanksgiving is the day that America invaded in 1983. And Morris Bishop was, I think they actually killed him. So if you go to Grenada in classic Rastafari style, they have a great party and they light some deodorants on fire and they write on the walls in the town, Morris Bishop is alive, he's not dead, and stuff like that. And that's their Thanksgiving. So it's arbitrary. It's just different things. It's not a real thing. So and like in Grenada, they also have another big festival. It's like Emancipation Day. So I was in Sweden, and they have this summer solstice. It's a great deal. It's a big deal because, you know, half the year is just cold, dark, and then in the summertime, it actually doesn't get completely dark at night. So it's a big deal for them because light and, you know, we're happy. And that's not the case in Grenada, because Grenada is very close to the equator, so every day is pretty much the same day going on all year round, so they don't really care about summer solstice. They care about Emancipation Day, because they were slaves coming over from Africa some 100 years ago. So this is just, it's arbitrary, it's not real, it's just circumstantial. It's just based on the geography or the history or whatever it is. So it's not really culture. If you take culture as being something that cultivates, the verb of cultivating something, then you can't really say that mundane culture qualifies. It's just, if enough people have the same misconception about who we are, then you call it culture. American culture, Grenada culture, Swedish culture, you know. It has nothing to do with us. So that's why the Vedic culture is important, because that actually brings out who we really are, right? It keeps us regulated, it keeps us simple, and it keeps us humble. If you Google something, I give this seminar sometimes, Culture of the Divine, which is basically on this. So sometimes when I do that, I like to Google like where I am. Like I did it in Sweden, so I Googled Swedish culture and just saw what popped up. You can take click images, and then just pictures pop up. And it's food, and it's Volvo, you know. and you got all these random things coming up, and it's just got nothing to do with culture. What is being cultivated here? But that's their sense of identity. It's all bogus. You know, who's... I mean, Swedish culture, Volvo, really? And IKEA, you know, was there. So we want to revive our true identity. Because when we do that, I mean, then we become Krishna conscious. That is what Krishna conscious is. It's the revival of our true identity. So that's why we need the culture. And that's why there are rules for us. So the thing is that we have to be very... See, we're very unfortunate. Like Mahaprabhu says in Sikshastakam that it's such an easy position, but I'm so unfortunate, I have no attraction for these names, right? So that's very unfortunate. It's unfortunate in itself that we're just in the material world. Now, the next level is that it's unfortunate that we're in Kali Yuga, because Satya Yuga was arguably quite a bit better. But then we have this very easy process of just chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And we can't even be bothered to do that. So that's very unfortunate. That's an unfortunate position to be in. So we have to be very merciful, right? We have to be compassionate. So when people get disturbed, we're in this false culture, and it's not happening. I'm not happy. I'm not getting what I thought I would get. And then these ideas come up. Maybe it's depression, maybe it's stress, or different like sort of mental disorders, ultimately culminating in suicidal tendencies, right? We have to be very compassionate. I've recently spoke with one lady, and she was very dejected because one senior devotee had told her that, no, I mean, if you have a child and it's being molested at home, basically the child was asking for it. You know, because we know the karma, you know, you just get what you deserve. That's how karma works. Now, that's not really a very constructive way of dealing with an issue, because it's very difficult to accept suffering. We're not meant actually to be suffering, right? So it's very difficult. And of course, if you take the extreme cases of like child abuse or whatever it may be, this is very heavy for us to deal with. A lot of emotions are in this. So we have to be very compassionate. That no, it's not that anyone asks to be molested. I mean, it seems logical. It's just that because we're in illusion, we make choices that put us in a situation we didn't think we would end up in, right? Nobody goes for suffering. Nobody is attracted to it. I mean, okay, in the modern society, you might even have some who have developed such a mode of ignorance that they actually go for suffering. That's there, but usually we don't. I mean, it's actually, even if it is like some kind of self mutilation or what it is, it's still based on a sense that this will benefit me. This will help me in some way, right? I will express myself through this. So it's still an attempt at some kind of happiness or some kind of pleasure, right? So when people, souls, jivas, end up in these problematic circumstances, it's not that they were asking for it. It's not that they had it coming. That's not the position we take as devotees. It's that it's a very dangerous place, the material creation as a whole. It's like an ocean where you're thrown here and there, and you just the modes of material nature are so strong that they pull us everywhere. So unknowingly and unwittingly, we end up in these situations. And our job as devotees is to help each other, help whoever out of this situation, to have mercy for all living entities, right? So that is basically what we're trying to do with the whole Krishna consciousness movement, right? that if we follow the laws of God, then there will be no reformation needed. The reformation is needed when we're not following the rules, right? We're being selfish, childish. You know, that's what you do when you raise a child. You correct the child. You reform it, because basically a small child is insane. You know, I was in Norway. I was staying with God siblings who have a 2-year-old. And, you know, I'm a brahmachari. I don't usually hang around with 2-year-olds. So I was kind of studying this child. It's just insane what goes on in this brain. And it's just never ending. It's like everything has to be put in the mouth or food on top of the head. Or it's just endless possibilities. It was fascinating, you know. However, if we fast forward, let's say 10 or 20 years, and imagine that the child is on the same platform doing the same kind of activities, maybe we wouldn't consider it as cute. You know, maybe it would be a little more like awkward. So everything in our life is we're reforming ourselves from childhood to adulthood. The question is, how far do we go, right? So you have modern man. They can like kind of control their bodily functions, so they can actually use the toilet and stuff like that. But in terms of going beyond just the sensory joy and pleasure, there's not really any program, right? I mean, we hear very prominent members of society say that we don't need God, we don't need philosophy. So basically, you don't need any understanding of who you are. That's what you're saying. So that's what we would say, extremely childish. If you ask the Hare Krishnas what we would say about that worldview, we would say that is extremely childish. And furthermore, it will not work. And we see that. We see that in the world today, I mean, depression is on the rise. Suicidal tendencies are on the rise. And actually, here's the fun part, is that there is a connection between intelligence and risk of suicide. That actually, the more intelligent you are, the higher your risk is that you will at some point commit suicide. Because what happens is that when you're intelligent, you can see this is not working out. But if you don't have philosophy or religion, if you have no program for how to elevating yourself, how to connecting yourself to something greater than just your own senses, then what are you going to do with yourself? So there, I read one study from the United States, found that they'd studied 3,000, I think, extremely gifted children. They had 300% risk of committing suicide compared to the general population. And mind you, that's not the general population of the world. That's the general population of the United States, which is already high on suicide risk. So it's a risky business if you don't have this program. If you're not connected to something that's higher than yourself, you're at risk, right? It's said in Bhagavatam that there are only two happy people. There's the Muda and the Paramahamsa, right? The Muda is just the fool. He's just a fool. And the Paramahamsa, obviously, is the exalted devotee, because the fool doesn't know that he's suffering, and the Paramahamsa isn't suffering. Everybody in between, there's some element of suffering. There's some element of hankering for something that I don't have, that I wish I had. Or even Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that this last snare of Maya is the idea that I'm an advanced devotee. That even will generate problems for us. That even we get problems out of performing bhakti, because we become very qualified and we get all the facility and everybody's nice and we start to enjoy that. So we get attached to it, and then we're still within this wheel of samsara. It's still going to drag us towards this material world, which is basically full of suffering. So we need to get out, and that is done by the culture and by the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, right? So it's not two separate things. It's one thing that has different different aspects, right? So let's see. So the acceptance that there are rules is difficult in the material world. We have, see, this is the problem. It generates itself, kind of. The problem generates itself because we're not following the Vedic culture. That means that we're not actually dealing properly with children. We have a tendency that young children, they will be, they have to learn how to sleep on their own. So we just ignore them when they're crying, right? That is not recommended, because that will generate a problem with authority. Because you basically grow up with this idea that I can't trust those who are superior to me. Now, this is a problem in society, in marriage, in any aspect of life, because there's always going to be someone who's in a superior position. If you trust that person, then you can get a lot of benefit from it. Of course, the person should be qualified, but just as a principle. But if you don't trust authority, just flat out, generically, I don't trust authority, then it's going to be very difficult to actually learn anything or to grow, right? How are you going to grow? If you don't trust anyone who is in a superior position than you, you can only deal with people who are less, inferior to you. Now, whatever you associate with, you take on those qualities. So that's why we see the whole society is kind of sinking, right? So what happens then is that your own children will have the same problem, and then it just keeps going like that, and it's a very characteristic for the West that culturally speaking there is this problem with authority. We always want to challenge authority. Now, of course, it makes sense, because we're living in a fundamentally exploitative culture. It's all based on sense gratification. Sense gratification is exploiting the universe for our own good. So when that is the fundamental mood, then of course your authorities are going to be very difficult to trust. We just had recently a general election in England, also in Denmark. And I'm not seeing a lot of trust in our politicians. I mean, even those materialistic voters who are very into politics and think that, oh, we can solve the problems with politics, they are not, they're in illusion, but they're not in that much illusion that they think that these politicians are actually worth trusting with anything, right? They know they're all rascals. And, you know, check out the media. What is the narrative of the media? It's just that everything is dangerous, but if you buy this product, you'll be happy. Everybody knows it's not true, you know? We're surrounded by people we cannot trust. Bankers? I mean, really, you know? These are the people, these are the prominent people in our society, so how are you going to trust authority? You know? When you check out religion, you get a lot of Muslims are with their guns, or you have some sect in the United States where the guy was a nonsense. It's all portrayed as something you cannot trust. So it's natural that you would have this fundamental lack of trust in authority. However, if you want to get anywhere, you need to accept authority. Even like take a mundane university. How are you going if the professor comes in, starts talking immediately, you just question everything he says? It's not going to work. You're not going to go through, and get a degree with that mood. So we have to figure out who to trust. You know, we have to put some effort into that. Now, we're very fortunate because we've found this movement and we have a lot of trustworthy leaders in our movement. Sometimes a leader will make a mistake and there will be some problem, but generally we're doing pretty well. We're all trying to be sincere devotees, you know. We're all trying to purify ourselves. We're all trying to serve. We have still the anarthas from the material consciousness, But, you know, as we go along, it's a little bit of a bumpy ride because we don't really have this culture as something that we, you know, we haven't grown up with this culture. So it's all a little bit alien. So if we just acknowledge that it's a little bit of a bumpy ride and don't get too fried out about it. Because that was the problem with this lady I mentioned before, that she got dejected to the point where she started doubting Krishna, you know. But the problem is not Krishna. The problem is that ISKCON is a movement of fallible people, people who make mistakes, who sometimes don't express themselves precisely, or some misunderstanding is there. That's the problem. So we have to remember that. We have to distinguish between God, who is the cause of all causes, the, you know, absolute supreme truth. And then we have ISKCON, which is an organization, an institution made up of devotees. And then you have the devotee, him or herself, right? That if I have a problem with a devotee, that should not necessarily reflect bad on ISKCON. And if I have a problem with ISKCON, that's a little worse, but it shouldn't necessarily reflect poorly on Krishna. Because he's not running, I mean, in a sense he is, but he's letting us do it, you know, to the best of our abilities. So again, the compassion must be there, that when we are making mistakes or if we're expressing ourselves in an incomplete way or some misunderstanding is there, then that compassion and forgiveness can kind of smooth things out. And in that way, we can remain to have faith in Krishna. Because it's not a matter of faith or not, it's a matter of faith in what. There's no question of not having faith in anything, right? So we might as well go for the highest quality. That's Krishna, because he has all the qualities. All the qualities are emanating from him. I mean, materialists have faith in money, sex, whatever it is. They have strong, firm faith. And then, as we were saying earlier, when it turns out, okay, this is not actually working, this is not making me happy, that's when the problems start. So our ability to have faith in Krishna will determine our success, right? So if we can do it within ISKCON, that's better. And if we can do it with also faith in every single devotee, that's the highest. If our ability to see everybody as a pure devotee, actually, that would be a very high platform. This is what we see also with the Goswamis or the Acharyas. They are serving everybody. They can see Krishna in everybody, right? So that's what we're trying to progress towards. That's why we have regulation. Why suicide is considered a sin, and we should very much. We should be aware of that, you know. I'm not sitting here preaching in the sense you can't commit suicide. You can, but it won't work. That's what we're trying to give knowledge of. It's not going to work. Your problem would not go away. So people are not actually trying to kill themselves. Like, you know, the soul is in the heart, but the mind is in the brain. So what do people do? They don't shoot themselves in the heart. They shoot themselves in the brain, right? Because it's a matter of, I want this material mind to stop bothering me. I'm so disturbed now, it's just too much, I just want it to stop. But it's not life as such. It's just this nagging material mind that just will not quit with, you have to do this and that guy said and whatever it is. At some point, it just becomes too much. And suicide or depression or schizophrenia, all these things are completely normal reactions to very extraordinary circumstances, right? The Western society has this tendency to look at them as sick. They're not sick. Society is sick. Material society is sick. And it pushes people into situations where they end up doing stuff like this. But our ability to apply the philosophy and apply the culture will help us. It will keep us from those situations by keeping us detached from all these sick activities that are going on around us. So I think I'll take a few questions now if anyone has anything, or chastisements or corrections.